Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our guest today is Jonathan Lande from McClatchy Newspapers. That's McClatchyDC.com. Welcome back to the show, Jonathan. How are you doing?
I'm well. Thank you very much.
Good. Well,
good to be back.
Happy to hear it. And you're welcome and very happy to have you here. Appreciate it. Now, I want to ask, well, who knew about the situation in Iraq, but not in just a kind of flippant way. I mean, it's important to me, I think, that you get credit for being one of the few mainstream newspaper reporters who, and I mean few, who did not just go along with the in-crowd, basically, the way they did, and help to lie us into war back in 2002 and 3. In fact, you were reporting the truth about the agenda to push us into war with Iraq beginning in the fall of 01. People can find those archives there. You and Warren Strobel, too, there at Knight Ridder News Service back then. And so that's very important. People can watch all about that in the PBS Bill Moyers documentary, Buying the War, which is still online and which is really great that I hope y'all will look at. So that's important to bring up. But I want to get to, and I haven't gone back to review what it was that you wrote back then, Jonathan, lately here, but I wonder whether much of it had to do with what are going to be the consequences for the Iraqi people who, at that point in the American debate, were largely imaginary and weren't apparently going to have a say in how any of this happened once the war happened. And then I wonder if also you could just, you know, talk about people, other people who knew. I mean, I was just a skater, cab driver, nobody kid doing pirate radio, and I had read a stupid Tom Clancy novel where Saddam Hussein gets assassinated and the Iranians inherit the south of the country in the snap of fingers, right there. So I had that much knowledge that there's some schism going on here and some things might take place, and I was just driving a cab in the middle of the night. So I wonder what the best and the brightest that you were talking to in D.C. were really saying when they weren't lying us into war.
Well, indeed, one of the first pieces we wrote when we actually reported my former colleagues, Warren Strobel and John Walcott, reported, I believe it was in February of 2002 or January, that the administration had decided to invade Iraq. And we started writing pieces. I wrote, remember one anyway, a major piece on here are the possible consequences. And they included taking the lid off what had been centuries of enmity between the Shia and Sunni branches of Islam, that Saddam, who was a Sunni and presided over a Sunni-dominated minority regime that suppressed the Shiites in the Shia in Iraq, that taking the lid off that pot could be extremely dangerous in terms of igniting sectarian violence. And indeed, you know, fast forward a couple years, and that's exactly what happened. The fact is that what also happened during that time, after the American invasion, was the creation of an entity known as Al-Qaeda in Iraq. This was an Al-Qaeda branch that had not existed prior to the United States invasion, and that was the forerunner of the group that is now on an offensive, the Sunni terrorist group that is now on an offensive from the north of Iraq towards Baghdad. They're about 60, I believe, about 60 kilometers south, north of Baghdad now. That was the forerunner, that group. And indeed, throughout this entire period, Iraq has not known peace. There was a period, several years ago when, the level of terrorist violence was low, but nevertheless it was never wiped out. That group never went away, and the idea that somehow Iraq was calm and peaceful when the Bush administration handed the tiller over to the Obama administration. It's just pure nonsense.
Yeah, well, it's amazing that those are the goalposts of this narrative here. The argument being played out, especially on TV, is, you know, whether we should have stayed, you know, whether Obama should have forced Maliki to let him stay and all that kind of thing. I mean, never mind that. But
well,
my
response to that would be, how? When you had the fact that George Bush in 2008 signed an agreement with Maliki, by the way, Shiite prime minister, that the United States helped put in power in a deal with Iran that pushed aside Iyad Alawi, who was the Iraqi politician who had actually won parliamentary elections. We helped put Maliki in power, and he one of the last things that Bush did when he left before he left office was sign this agreement with Maliki that specified, mandated a U.S. withdrawal, all troops out by the end of 2011. Obama comes into power, and he tried to negotiate an agreement with Maliki that would have at least put kept 3,000 U.S. military trainers in Iraq. And granted, the fact is that the U.S. military wanted to keep more troops there, wanted a bigger troop presence. But here you had a government, Maliki, and his parliament, and others, and Iran, that were saying, no way are we going to let shoot any U.S. troops stay behind. And that would have been a deal also that would have been rejected by the Congress, because it would have required U.S. troops to, but what Maliki was demanding and what Obama was refusing was that U.S. troops who stayed would be subject to Iraqi law, whereas the Obama administration was saying, no, they need to be exempted from Iraqi law, and U.S. troops need to remain subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice. That would be the U.S. Uniform Code of Military Justice. So those negotiations collapsed. So the idea that keeping American troops there might have staved off what this disaster that we've seen unfolding since last week is also revisionist nonsense. Because the fact is that you had an Iraqi army that was up in the north, that was Shiite dominated, and that was not getting along with the population there. The population was incredibly opposed to, came to oppose the Iraqi army presence in the north. And the fact is also that you still had this terrorist group, ISIS, or some people refer to ISIL, that was operating not just in Syria, but was still operating in Iraq.
All right, so... Well, there's a lot to go over here, but I guess, first and foremost, what do you think the U.S. is going to do now?
Well, it's going to be really interesting to see, because of one of the ironies of this disaster is that by intervening on the side of the Iraqi government, which has now asked formally the United States to stage airstrikes against ISIS, the United States effectively finds itself on the same side as Iran, and effectively finds itself on the same side as the Syrian dictator Bashar Assad, because Assad is fighting ISIS as well. Don't forget, ISIS spans the border. They control parts of northeastern Syria and a large part of Iraq. And so, I mean, it remains to be seen what's going to happen. But the fact is, it's quite an extraordinary situation. The United States, I don't think, can change the facts on the ground through airstrikes. We'll have to wait and see. And usually when you mount airstrikes, you need eyes on the ground to spot targets or to laze targets. And that could mean, I don't know if that means necessarily putting U.S. Special forces on the ground. We have to wait and see. But certainly... What the United States has been trying to do, and Iran apparently, is trying to push Maliki to reach out to politicians from the Kurd, leadership of the Kurds, leadership of Sunnis who are opposed to this takeover by this terrorist group in association with former Baathists and tribal militias, to try and somehow rescue some kind of multi-secular
right,
Iraqi...
We'll be right back. Jonathan, we got to take this break. We'll be right back.
Yeah, sure.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you could hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me, scott@scotthorton.org, for more information. See you there.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Jonathan Landay from McClatchy Newspapers about the continuing war in Iraq. And so right up against the break, we were talking about the coalition they're trying to put together against ISIS now, which includes the Iranians. And I think it's notable. It's definitely notable. It's quantifiably notable that America's been fighting for Iran and Iraq since 2003. That was exactly what the king of Saudi Arabia said was, hey, it's in the Chelsea Manning WikiLeaks State Department cables. It was always you and us and Saddam against Iran, but now you're going to hand Iraq to Iran on a golden platter, he said. And
That's what happened.
And in 2003, I mean, it was, I think it was March. It wasn't even April. It was still March 2003 when the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution and the Badr Brigades crossed the border from Iran back into Iraq.
I was there. I watched them come across. I was in Kurdistan when they came across.
Take it from there, Jonathan. Sorry.
I was there. They came across into Kurdistan. Well, it was actually, let me think. It may have been, somewhere in March. Yep.
And so that's the catbird seat. That was it. The Iranians had the opposition prepared. Whatever Chalabi had promised Richard Pearl was null and void that day.
Right. And the fact is that the Iranians probably played a much bigger role in secretly sucking the United States into that disaster by sponsoring or at least putting up some of Chalabi's quote-unquote defectors on whose garbage information and bogus intelligence the Bush administration relied in part. We remember the ice cream and yogurt trucks biological weapons labs disguised as mobile milk and yogurt trucks.
Sure.
Well,
Colin Powell had a very convincing cartoon of what one might look like if they had a picture of one.
Right. and you know, the fact is that people have forgotten all of that, or they seem to have, and those people include, unfortunately, television cable news bookers.
Well, you know what Jonathan,
is these people on the air again, have revived them, and they've gone on the air to spew revisionist garbage.
Yeah, well, TV never told the truth. TV never put up a map and said, let's talk a little bit about Sunni and Shia and who's cleansing who from Baghdad right now and this kind of thing. Who's on whose side? They never talked about that. It was always just the democracy versus the terrorists or whatever, the whole damn war. They would never be honest. So, of course, they don't know anybody who knows anything about it to interview because they never did.
That's not true. I mean, Scott, there are a lot of people who understood what was going on, who understood the disaster that we were getting sucked into. They were talking to us. That's how we were able to do the reporting that we were able to do.
No, I don't mean that. I mean the cable TV news people doing the booking. They don't know who you are. They've never met you or heard of Knight Ritter before or anything like that. All they know is, well, that Wolfowitz guy is the genius, right? What do they know?
I don't know
about
that they consider him a genius, but they look at the name. They see, oh, look, he's the former Deputy Secretary of Defense. Let's put him on. The most egregious are the Wall Street Journal op-ed editors who fail to police the historical trash that is being revived or being printed on their op-ed page.
Yeah. It is. It's really out of control with what's going on in the media right now, where even Judith Miller, I read that Judith Miller was featured on Fox to complain about the media coverage isn't being warlike enough on this issue right now.
Apparently she was on. I saw a screen grab. I did not bother tuning in to listen. None of them should have any credibility at all to the extent that they should be presented to the American people again.
Right, now let me ask you this.
After what they've put this country in through.
Well, and what they've put Iraq through, and there's still so much to cover here, Jonathan. Let me ask you this. It looks to me, just from the map, like, and I'm not saying either side necessarily recognizes it the way I recognize it, but I wonder, it looks like a stalemate to me. It looks like Maliki, you know, he's been shelling Fallujah angrily for a while. He's not really trying to retake Fallujah after all these months. His army turned and ran, like you said, because they're the Shiite army. They're the army of the country from Baghdad to Basra. They're not really the army of the eastern part of the country. And I wonder whether, you know, it doesn't. And with Baghdad being an 85% Shiite city now, the ISIS guys can't be fool enough to think that they can really take the city. They can suicide bomb it. They can't really take the city back after the army and the Marine Corps gave it to the Shiites. So, you know, is this just the Declaration of Independence? This is now the end of Maliki pretending to be the government of the North and the West, and this is now the end of the Sunnis pretending to go along with this awakening crap where they're going to participate and be allowed to participate in the government in Baghdad.
Well, we'll have to wait and see, because I think you're right. I mean, the fact is that the weight of the numbers alone mitigate against any possibility that ISIS is going to be able to quote-unquote conquer Baghdad, although, you know, no one really expected them to conquer Mosul either. But there's a couple of other considerations here, and the one I would point you to is the fact that ISIS has declared its intent to destroy the holiest shrines in Shia Islam, which happen to be located in Iraq, in Samarra, in Karbala, and in Najaf. Mm-hmm. Those are red lines for the country on the other side of the border, Iran. And I don't think that there's going to be a situation. I don't think Iran is going to allow or will brook any kind of possibility that these shrines are going to be destroyed by these Sunni extremists. I think you would certainly see, if there was a danger of that, I think you would see active Iranian military intervention, although let's not forget there are numerous news reports for days now that the head of the Quds Force, General Soleimani, who, by the way, was the architect of saving Bashar Assad, is now doing the same for Maliki.
Mm-hmm. And now, what about the primacy of the tribes over ISIS? The Black Banners get all the headlines, but isn't this the same old Sunni insurgency, and aren't they still the major power, the former Baathists and the local Sunni tribal leaders, et cetera, rather than this Baghdadi guy?
I think so. I mean, I haven't drilled down far enough into all of that to be able to say one way or the other, but the fact is that you know, certainly there are a lot of Baathists involved, former Baathists involved, and once this is over, if it's ever over, I think you're going to see these groups falling out with each other because ideologically they're diametrically opposed. You've got Baghdadi and ISIS, which are extremist Sunnis, and you have the Baathists, who, let's not forget, were a secular political party that ruled Iraq and with a pretense towards the end, you know, with this sort of pretense towards Islam, but in fact we're secular, and I don't see how they are possibly going to be able to coexist once, if they ever get to the point where they conquer and secure a large piece of territory. We'll have to wait and see.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, when it comes to ISIS and the al-Nusra Front, which I guess is still back in Syria and sitting this part of the thing out here, can you give me ballpark numbers of how many guys? I hear different estimates all over the place, and I'm curious to know what you think.
You know what, I, Scott, I think any information that comes out of Syria regarding numbers, that kind of thing, is going to be, you know... speculation. I don't think any, you know, we've seen numbers in terms of the number of foreigners who are involved in ISIS. I've seen figure estimates of 7,000 to 10,000. I don't think anybody really knows. You know, I just got back from Syria. I mean, just made my second trip there, and you know, the fact is that the insurgency, or at least the Islamists, are battling each other, and for the time being, Bashar Assad has won.
Nusra and ISIS are fighting each other there.
Yes, Nusra with Arar al-Sham and the FSA are battling ISIS. Although there was reports the other day that ISIS has asked for and obtained a ceasefire. I forget exactly where it was in order to fight push back a regime offensive. While it is also tied down in Iraq.
All right, and now, so here's where I play Pollyanna for just a second here. We got this Iran deal, which, I don't know, I like to give 60-40, what the hell, why not, of a chance of a final nuclear deal here. And there was talk from, I don't know, one or another Saudi prince or so-called minister of government who said, you know what, hey, if the Americans want to lead the way on warming up relations with Iran, we could be cool with that, you know, let's do that. And obviously there's no consensus there about it, but it just seems like it's such an obvious thing to do, not to necessarily ally outright with the Badr Brigade again or anything like that, but at least to, you know, end the Cold War with Iran, which then pulls the rug out from under this entire crisis of the Shiite Crescent by making it no longer a big deal that Iran is friends with Syria and Hezbollah, et cetera, because Iran, they ain't so bad anymore, kind of a thing. And then it seems like maybe that could help really take the pressure off the Saudis to do so much funding of the Mujahideen in Syria, Iraq, and everywhere else. And, you know, maybe things could be a little bit better around there. But I guess I'm way down a slippery slope argument.
Yeah, I think you're way down the road right now. I think you're way down the road. I think that neither side is looking to really make any kind of major deals outside of the nuclear deal, and then to say, okay, what next? Because you still have a serious, you know, you still have, first of all, domestically in both Iran and the United States, you have the domestic political opposition to any kind of not just nuclear deal, but I mean, not just you know, a deal on Iraq, but the nuclear deal and any kind of deal dealings. But then there's also there are also other questions, especially about, you know, at least as far as the United States goes, you know, Iranian sponsorship and support of Hezbollah and Hezbollah. Terrorist operations that have targeted people in Europe and Latin America, and I think we're a long ways off from sort of like this, you know, grand bargain, because I don't think the United States is prepared to support any kind of continued Iran, you know, to be seen to support any kind of continued Iranian support for Hezbollah, which is the sworn enemy of Israel.
Yeah.
So I think we're way down the road on that right now.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I mean, I think that's why the Leverts always say we need to kind of make an overall peace first and then deal with the individual issues the way that Mao and, Nixon and Kissinger did with Mao, taking a piecemeal, because it makes it so difficult to get any of them done while all the rest of the issues are still outstanding. But
right, but don't forget also that once upon a time, 2000, and I'm trying to remember the, I don't want to get my date wrong, but I want to say 2005, I think it was, there was an offer from the former Iranian government of Ayatollah of Khatami. It was an overall package deal that would have included a deal on the nuclear program.
Yeah, 05.
That was rejected
by
who?
The E3 negotiations of 03 through 05 you're talking about. Right.
Right, and it was Dick Cheney who said no, who put the kibosh on that.
Right. Well, the reason I'm so hopeful about it, I know I get carried away, but the reason I'm so hopeful about it is it seems like the nuclear issue is the major outstanding issue. Not that Hezbollah is no big deal or anything, but it seems like if we could get this thing out of the way, then maybe we can make that next step. But without getting this thing out of the way, it seems like it'll always be the endless threats of options on tables and all that crap, same as always. So, anyway.
Right.
But thank you for your time. I've kept you way over time. I really appreciate it, Jonathan.
Anytime, Scott.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, y'all, Scott here. So you made a little bit of money in this horrid economy only to find that the Fed has more or less outlawed saving. So into the treacherous waters of the stock market bubble you go. But how to make a little money without too much risk of losing it all? Check out WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who opens a very real window into his main account, updating his subscribers on the facts of and the reasoning behind all his market moves. Follow along on paper or with real money and see what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell you heard it here.